Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
From our studios at KUOM, on the West Bank of the University of Minnesota campus, this is Culture Q, the art show that rocks. This week on Culture Q, where's the party?
So much of modern politics is a show. And so I think it makes sense to have a show that's about modern politics.
There's only so many minutes of commercials we can run every hour.
You can graduate with tens of thousands in debt and then no job lined up for you. Like, why aren't we more angry is what I wonder.
Good evening and thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Mark Sheely. This Tuesday, you may know, you'll have some decisions to make. Not only are you going to choose who should be the president of these United States, but you'll also be deciding on U.S. Senate and congressional seats, two amendments to Minnesota's Constitution, and countless other school board, city council, and judges' positions in your neighborhood. Amidst the slew of political ads and the horse race style of election coverage, it's easy to forget that there's an art to our elections, as well as some fun to be had. So tonight in our show, we're bringing you stories from our perspectives. As young voters, as voters curious about the money behind political advertising, and as voters looking for some entertainment in all the seriousness of election night. All that and more is coming up, so do your civic duty and stay tuned, because Culture Q begins right now. The 2008 election saw a record turnout of young voters. So in our first story of the night, reporter Jamie Nelson examines whether that momentum at the polls has faded after 4 years, or if issues like the marriage amendment will bring young people back to the voting booth on November 6th.
At the Riverview Theater in Minneapolis, Democrats in Minnesota hosted a presidential debate viewing party. All ages came out and to watch the candidates on the big screen. The older crowd arrived early, participating in rabble-rousing speeches, a re-election-themed spiritual, and some serious heckling. While the young folks at this event were either tabling for the Vote No campaigns or trickling in really late. The youth vote this time around is a bit quieter.
So I think it was a lot easier for Obama to win, and I think it was easier for him to make a stand on a lot of different issues that really resonated with this generation. I think people might be a little bit more leery this time around, and they might not necessarily be as inclined to just get out and vote like they were in 2008.
A new election cycle means a new batch of issues. But is the excitement for this election the same as the last? For the youth vote, some of the issues remain the same.
Tuition, definitely tuition.
Massive amounts of debt, loans upon loans.
Growth in the economy.
The economy, economy, economy.
Student loans, it's freaking ridiculous, right? Like, that you can graduate from 4 years with tens of thousands in debt and then no job lined up for you. Why aren't we more angry is what I wonder.
Not only concerned about student loans, Robert Hembel also noticed a lack of a certain topic in all the debates.
Working on environmental justice issues, climate justice issues, and it's been really appalling to me that that hasn't been an issue in this campaign at all. This is going to affect all of us, from the flooding up in Duluth to the droughts all over the Midwest. You know, people were freaking out over the bacon shortage last year, or coming up next year. That's a direct result of the changes in climate we're seeing. And so,
tuition, economy, jobs, a looming bacon shortage. Some of the issues remain the same, but for young Minnesotans in particular, this time around, there are some issues which are new.
There's the amendments on the ballot, and that's something that was definitely, not around last time. And I think that, young people in general just feel a lot differently on those issues in particular than maybe our parents and our grandparents do.
Now, whenever I asked a young voter who they were voting for in this election, I was often told...
So I am voting no on both these amendments. I'm leading with that.
Jeremy Reichenberger, member of U of M Campus Democrats.
I think this year, especially with, the ballot initiatives, I think that's going to be something that's definitely going to drive youth to the polls. I think this election, like, I have friends who don't vote for president. They don't vote for candidates. They're not into politics. But I think these ballot initiatives are definitely something that are driving them to the polls this time.
Quinn Juergens, a member of Campus Republicans, agrees. He thinks that is not necessarily the election, but the amendments that are bringing out voters his own age.
I think the presidential vote is a little bit of a byproduct of the amendments. Frankly, I am planning on voting no, but I will also plan to vote for Mitt Romney.
Juergens goes on to explain that as a young Republican, he's voting no for the marriage amendment because he believes the amendments are too divisive and a distraction from the issues that are more important. He says that they shouldn't even be on the ballot, which may come as a surprise. Catherine Pearson, professor of political studies at the U of M, explains that among young Republicans, Juergens' voting pattern is actually not that surprising. This year we see
an overwhelmingly high percentage of Republicans in favor of the amendments. That's not the case among younger Republicans. And so, in particular with the marriage amendment, this is an issue where younger voters and older voters really, really differ when it comes to public opinion.
You might say then that the youth vote's political identity differs to some degree.
Most voters do associate with one party or the other, even if they don't frame their choices in those terms. But I do think for younger voters, the party attachments are less significant. That doesn't mean they don't influence their voting. They certainly do, but they're more interested in talking about these issues, particularly issues that that are changing and where the party queue is less helpful for younger voters.
She explains that it's not necessarily that the amendments bring out more youth voters, but
I think the activism among younger voters is most centered around the amendments. Certainly, I observe many more T-shirts and stickers about the amendments than I do about the presidential race, which is a real switch from 4 years ago in my classroom.
Won't you help us re-elect this president?
What motivates the youth vote this time around is different, and the predicted turnout for the youth vote is expected to be much lower than before. Regardless,
I think that it's important that youth take time to feel like they can be a part of the system. Really feeling like you're part of something bigger is, I think, the key to that.
This is Jamie Nelson for Culture Q.
Whoever is elected president, they'll have some pressing issues to address in their first days of office, but none quite so fundamental as the question asked by new reporter Alex Van Ness in our Question of the Week. He asked people around town to imagine themselves elected president and then posed the question, who's the first guest that you would invite to the White House?
I don't think I'd invite anyone to the White House because it might be spies and other people. Don't trust them.
I would just invite everyone.
I'd definitely bring my bros Mario and Luigi because, you know, they've pushed me in everything I've done, like in racing and punching people and brawling like that. You know, I gotta treat them to something very nice.
Two people. I invite my parents. I just think that'd be really cool, something that they'd probably never be able to see otherwise, like an inside look at the White House, but probably out of appreciation for them getting to me to where I would be, obviously, as a president.
Barack Obama, because he would not be president and would need something to fill his time.
My first guest would definitely be my parents and my brother and sister. I would say because I would have a long time campaigning and I'd be away from home for a long time, so it'd be really cool to see them and invite them to my new house for the next couple years.
I would invite Gandalf the Wise to the White House because I feel like he's a pretty smart guy and he'd know how to best run the country.
Ray Lewis from the Baltimore Ravens. He's the greatest middle linebacker ever to play in the NFL.
My first guest would be James Brown, and I would make him the Secretary of Soul.
My first guess would probably be Superman, because he's always got my back, and he's definitely one of the people that I'd want to be there.
I would have a personal chef in case I get hungry.
I'd invite Jesus, Abraham Lincoln, Pope John Paul II, Pope Benedict XVI. I'd invite Bon Jovi, Chuck Norris, Dracula, Evel Knievel, and my mom.
We'll be right back.
there, Culture Q. This is Amy Friedman.
And Robert Schoen, and we're here with the top seven people you should write in on this year's ballot.
So first up, we have Sensation, Honey Boo Boo. And the reason that she made this list is because she's taken a very controversial stance on gay marriage.
Ain't nothing wrong with being a little gay. Everybody's a little gay.
You should know that she's not vegetarian or vegan. She's carnivorous in every way, and she would love to have deer, roadkill deer, that is, at the White House every night for dinner.
And next up on the list is none other than your mother.
Well, I know we just had Thanksgiving dinner, but you're watching the game. Don't you want a snack?
No.
Popcorn, peanuts. Oh, what the heck is this doing here? M&Ms, crackers. I got crackers. I can make you a cheese and cracker plate. Honey?
And that's just one example of how your mother, as president, would conduct meetings.
I don't know about you, Amy, but my mother loves to bake banana bread and zucchini bread, and I just think that having that scent wafting out of the Oval Office every morning would be really, really nice.
I really like how assertive mothers are, too. I want to see more of that in our foreign policy. Like, instead of economic sanctions or your usual diplomacy, has anyone tried taking these people's Facebooks away? Or maybe grounding them? When was the last time Putin got grounded?
At number five on your top seven, we have none other than Abraham Lincoln, but this time, Vampire Hunter.
I presume you know what I can do with this.
Well, I know what you can do against one vampire. But against 20?
I personally want to see more axes in our military, and I think that this is something that Vampire Hunter Lincoln can really bring to the table. We're always investing in expensive planes and drone technology, but where have all the axes gone? Coming up at number four on our list is Bill Cosby.
Because who wouldn't want the entire presidential cabinet to be wearing Bill Cosby sweaters in every meeting?
He really is just kind of the father of our nation. And I think a part of him becoming president should be that we're all required to change our last name to Huxtable. I would be proud.
I would be a very proud Huxtable as well. Number three on your top seven is the Sesame Street Gang. That's right, all of them.
This is controversial because it would mean an oligopoly, but I think it would be worth it. There's been a lot of talk of cutting funding to Sesame Street, but I think we need to go to the opposite direction, right? And elect them president.
Absolutely. Number two is Stephen Colbert, because who wouldn't want him as the president? I mean, we're already a Colbert nation. Why not just make it official?
And all the way at the top, number one for people you should write in this election is YouTube sensation,
Kid President.
Everybody just chill out. It's me, Kid President.
His most famous quote, don't be in a party, be a party.
I'm not in a party, I am a party. Everywhere I go is a party.
Also, his second most famous quote would be, you can't be sad when you're holding a cupcake.
I am so sold on Kid President. I'm going to set up a super PAC for him right now. And he's going to need all of your guys' help, too, because it's going to be tough competition next to Sesame Street. I think they're sort of going for the same demographic.
I've been getting lots of emails about farting and policy.
And that was this week's top seven. Don't forget to vote, and more importantly, don't forget to write in one of these candidates from our top seven.
Chances are, if you were asked to name every single U.S. president, there would probably be at least several you couldn't recall. There are the rock stars, and then there are the caretakers of the office. But I found out about one theater production that will illuminate each and every one of them in a special performance on this upcoming election night. Walking into what will be the election night performance space for 44 plays for 44 presidents, you'll notice a few things. One, it's in a church basement. There's also no sophisticated lighting, no auditorium seating, but there is a stage. And to bring an office like the American presidency to life, that's all that director Karen Bratley and her cast of five actors really need.
So much of modern politics is a show. And so I think it makes sense to have a show that's about modern politics.
The original production was the creation of the Neo-Futurists of Chicago and debuted in 2002 as, of course, 43 plays for 43 presidents. This past summer, local company Theater Pro Rata put on several performances of 44 plays, but for their election night show, Bratley will be adding a crucial feature.
Number one, we're going to have live returns going. So during the play, we're going to be also posting the returns as they come back, which is a little nerve-wracking.
Several minutes for each president's play doesn't allow much time for historical exposition, and so at times, personality or infamy is favored over strict history.
This is for Taft, and it's a fat suit. Taft did other things in his presidency besides just be really, really fat. But when you've got 2 minutes, we'll just talk about him being really fat.
Besides the fat suit, the plays use all kinds of props, like inflatable baseball bats and more than a few rifles to illuminate each president. And adding to the absurdity of racing through more than 200 years of history in just 2 hours, each president gets their own named box that sits on stage and holds these symbols of their time in office. And, in case you were wondering, yes, Grover Cleveland does get two non-consecutive boxes.
So we have these giant beater inflatable things that say, this one says 18% unemployed, and this one says the Pullman car strike, and repeal the Sherman Silver Purchase Act. So in the second term, he gets beaten with all of these things.
If these depictions sound farcical, it's because in many ways, the plays mirror another long-kept political art form.
It's a little just like a political cartoon come to life.
But just as much as some plays caricaturize the presidents, others are meant to challenge our long-held notions of these men. Take President number 34, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Whether you remember him as a war hero or for the booming American economy during his time in office, Eisenhower's place in the American conscious is best summed up in his famous campaign slogan.
You like ice, I like ice, everybody likes ice for president. Hang out the banner, beat the drum, we'll take ice to Washington.
His depiction in 44 plays isn't as glowing.
In Brown versus the Board of Ed,
no integration schools closed instead.
Grudgingly back civil rights,
but his friends all wore white sheets at night.
I just think 90.
On the other hand, there's President number 37, Richard Nixon, whose popular caricature as a paranoid and scheming villain is probably best drawn in Fox's animated series Futurama.
I've become bitter, and let's face it, crazy over the years. And once I'm swept into office, I'll sell our children's organs to zoos for meat, and I'll go into people's houses at night and wreck up the place.
His play, however, urges you to look at the good that Nixon did in office.
Who started the EPA?
Richard Nixon did, Richard Nixon did.
And who
strengthened the NEA? Richard Nixon did, Richard Nixon did.
You know, you have to try really hard to make them very different people. And it's also hard to not editorialize when you get closer to presidents that you know.
That's actor David Bukema.
I play Washington, Jackson, Hearst, Cleveland, Eisenhower, and I play, I play George W. Bush.
While the action in some plays is built on just a single prop, Bukema says that maintaining the rapid pace from one president to another means looking for a single hook into a president's portrayal.
Since Washington is kind of like the model of what a president is, he started everything, so I just thought of him as really larger than life and kind of like a heroic figure striding majestically across the land.
Alongside performing the plays on election night is the fact that Theater Pro Rata is putting them on in the basement of Calvary Lutheran Church in South Minneapolis. And Karen Bratley says that's no coincidence.
One of the reasons why we chose this particular church basement was because it has the feel sort of the essence of an average American polling station, or a place where you would have sort of a civic event.
Chances are, if you're going to a play about the American presidents on election night, then you're already a pretty civic-minded person. And even if there is a play you don't like, Bratley says the solution is easy.
Well, it'll be over in 2 minutes, and there's another one after that.
So while the rest of us are waiting to see who will be the next leader of the free world, the writers of 44 plays for 44 presidents will see whether they can begin work on the 45th play, or whether it's four more years of 44. For Culture Q, I'm Mark Sheely. The economy has been a central issue of this election, but what effect has the election had on our economy? Producer Markita Fornoff looks at the effect that political ads have on the media market.
With the election only hours away, politicians and political action committees alike are making their last-minute effort to connect with voters. While you as a viewer or listener might feel overwhelmed by the amount of political ads, media outlets feel the same way.
Yeah, we're pummeled.
Ben Einsfar is a key account executive at Clear Channel Minneapolis, which is a part of a larger corporation known as Clear Channel Communications. Clear Channel Communications has over 850 radio stations nationwide. Its revenue is $1.59 billion, according to the most recent quarterly report. Einsfar helps maintain and develop accounts with advertising clients for the company's six radio stations throughout the metro area.
You know, and in the grand scheme of things, I mean, from the political standpoint, I mean, the only time that we're really stressed from an inventory standpoint is like literally the last handful of weeks, because it's such a tight window. There's only so many minutes of commercials we can run every hour.
These minutes of airtime are what Einsfar calls inventory. And no matter what season it is, they can only run 6 minutes of commercials per every hour. Though this number is fixed, demand and price are not. Jean Bay is an economics professor at Augsburg College who explains how this relationship works.
Company's revenue is price times quantity.
These prices depend on demand, which can be categorized as either elastic or inelastic.
An elastic demand would be price goes up about 1% and quantity demanded goes down by, say, 5%. So bigger increases, bigger changes in quantity demanded than in price. What you want is you raise the price by 1% and quantity demanded doesn't really change. Then your total revenue would go up.
To maximize profits and sales, Clear Channel uses a model that is similar to the way Hotwire and Priceline sell their plane tickets.
When the plane's not full, they have competitive pricing. As the plane begins to fill up and they realize that they'll probably sell all the seats on the plane, the pricing gets higher. Then, of course, if there's two seats left on the plane that's taking off tomorrow, the price comes back down as an incentive to try and get people to fill those.
All of this adjusting is aimed to hit what economists call an equilibrium.
Market equilibrium simply means it's the price at where the quantity supplied is equal to the quantity demanded. Every time you have a sale, then you have equilibrium, right? Somebody bought, somebody sold.
The political season for advertisers is like summer vacation for airlines, because not only is there an election going on, but the holidays are just around the corner too, meaning that candidates and companies are vying for the same airtime. However, there are laws that regulate the pricing of political ads for the candidates.
At the beginning of every year, when it's a political year, we come up with a rate card, which is our political rate card, and we are legally bound for candidate advertising to offer our lowest unit rate on average. It not only generates stress on our inventory when a lot of the ads come in, but it's, you know, not typically the best priced advertising either.
But this special rate doesn't apply for all ads of a political nature.
On the contrary, the issue advertisers have to pay a premium, 50% higher than our standard rate card.
So which is more valuable, the premiums or the discounts?
Probably a wash altogether.
But that's not necessarily true in other states.
I mean, a lot of this varies from state to state, too, you have to understand, because, you know, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are both substantially heavier in other states that aren't traditionally one way or the other. Like Wisconsin, I'm sure, is getting hammered because Wisconsin is always a swing state in the election. Minnesota, I think, once in the last 20-some years has not gone Democratic as a state. So if they kind of know they want to have a presence here, but it's not a key focus, whereas Wisconsin and Ohio being the swing states that they are, they could go either way. There's going to be a ton of media placed down there.
This is also different when comparing radio to other media.
TV is 10 times worse. Television, you're finding that, you know, the standard advertisers, what happens in a political year, so much comes down on the television that those clients are just getting their ads bumped. They're not paying for them, but they're not running what they ordered because there's, you know, they get preempted by the television advertising for political. Whereas in radio, we don't really have to bump anybody unless it's significant demand. And surprisingly, we didn't have as much this year as we thought we would with the two amendments to the Constitution on the ballot.
Political ads may influence the way people vote, but their economic effects on the media are
a flash in the pan.
For Culture Q, I'm Markita Fornoff, and I approve this message.
And that is all for our show tonight. Contributors to this week's show were Jamie Nelson, Amy Friedman, Robert Schoen, Alex Van Ness, Markita Fornoff, and me, Mark Sheely. Producers for Culture Q are Mitch Skinner, Noel Clark, Markita Fornoff, and Amy Friedman. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and host and managing editor is me, Mark Sheely. You can find Culture Q on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And if you miss something fascinating, you can always find recent episodes of Culture Q online at radiok.org. Thanks for listening, and as always, we'll see you next week. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.